Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, and I will try to make sense out of the nonsense and deliver a little bit of sanity to your week. This week, we'll start off with the horrific shooting in Washington, D.C. of two staffers at the Israeli embassy. We'll talk about that wild meeting between Donald Trump and the South African president in the Oval Office. Call it the latest chapter of the Oval Office sitcom. We'll talk about lots of other things. We'll go into the latest revelations about former President Biden. We'll talk about the DOJ opening investigation into Andrew Cuomo. It just feels like there's more every week. We're glad to have you here with us for it. And speaking of being with us, get excited. Sunday, we'll be releasing our interview and live event with Professor Alan Dershowitz, a living legal legend. And we touched on everything under the sun. So we can't wait for you to enjoy that.
Great. Okay. So I had two quotes of the week this week because I initially was thinking about commencement week, graduation at all these American universities, and the chaos and crazy that happened at some of our elite institutions. And then woke up and sort of read about, or I saw last night what happened in D.C. And so these two quotes sort of felt like where my head was at, and they kind of go together, actually. First is from founding father and second president John Adams, who said, "Our Constitution was made only for immoral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other," which, you know, makes me just feel generally, we've talked a lot about what's happening to the West, or, you know, I've been pretty vocal about what I think is happening to the West and the abandonment of our values and our core principles and the sort of rot culturally and personally, I think even individually, that happens when that happens. I think we're seeing that not only in our institutions, but on the streets of D.C. last night. The second quote was from an American university president, the president of the University of Kentucky. I had to go south to find a sane quote at a commencement address. And it's president, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, Eli Capilouto, who said the following at his commencement. "Our world so often seems marked by disorder rather than order. The default too frequently descends into disunity and discord rather than unity and harmony." And this was the key point. "We need you to create structure out of chaos, to use your purpose and passion to create structure and balance for you and for the communities where you live." This idea that order out of chaos, which of course, if you're a person of faith, you recognize as sort of a divine characteristic. Mm-hmm. But to emulate that as human beings, to have some sense of moral center, not just for yourself, but for the community that you're participating in and that you're trying to help build. And felt like the sanest thing you could say to a bunch of young people about to enter the world and try to build things rather than destroy them, which is what's happening on so many college campuses today.
Yeah. I mean, that invocation of structure is so resonant, right? There's such a kind of antipathy to structure now. It reminds you of that great poem by William Butler Yeats about the center not holding, and the importance of trying to hold or hold on. And, you know, I imagine you felt this way, and a lot of people listening, that sense of just disorder, you know, really came into focus last night with the murder of two really beautiful young people about to get engaged in Washington, D.C., in front of the Capitol Jewish Museum. They were at an event there for young diplomats, not only Israeli or Jewish diplomats, but people from all over the world, talking about trying to make the world a better place. The kind of event that, you know, I certainly went to a million of those when I lived in D.C. and have been to that museum. So it struck home for me on a number of different levels. This was a political act. I mean, this wasn't it was senseless in a broader way. But for the kind of ideology and hate and anti-Semitism that motivated it, it made all the sense in the world to this person who pulled the trigger.
Right. I think that's the point. And I would say while it is very specifically an act of anti-Semitism, it's reflective of this larger ideology. I could imagine that same person could be animated by a lot of the same feelings and emotions, these sort of oppressor versus oppressed paradigm that lives in his twisted brain, mm-hmm. That in this situation put, you know, Jews, one of them, people that he killed was actually a Christian.
Yeah.
But anybody who he viewed as sort of part of the oppressor class, there's some right to attack and kill because you are the oppressed. Mm. That mindset has caused violence, not just against Jews, but against all kinds of people in this country. And so I think we're all sort of focused on this, not only because it was an act of anti-Semitism, but because anti-Semitism was sort of the tip of the spear for a lot of other problems that we're seeing in this country, mm-hmm. and that we're all sort of targets of, yeah. in one way or the other. And so that ideology at its core is really what we're fighting.
Yeah. I went back, you know, and I actually rewatched that university president testimony with Elise Stefanik, mm-hmm. where, you know, she asked, you know, is globalizing the intifada, you know, is that violence, or is that violent rhetoric? Is it against, you know, free Palestine? I think, you know, a lot of Jews have known in their gut that this movement, I'm not saying everyone who is, you know, advocates for whatever, so solutions to the war, whatever, but the movement, this the free Palestine movement is rotten at its core, and that these slogans are violent. They promise violence. They aspire to violence. And we've certainly seen that on campuses, on the streets of New York. It is, to your point, a movement that is anti-West, anti-American, and anti-Jewish, in whatever order you want to list those. And Jews know this stuff. They know it in their bones. And like, it's so obvious that, you know, the kinds of, you know, vandalism and violence and covering faces with keffiyehs and violent chants. I mean, you know, to preview, Alan Dershowitz immediately compared it to the KKK. Now, you know, reach for any analogy you want, but this is an ugly facet that has become a part of American life.
Right. And I think people will watch the Dershowitz, yeah. Interview and see what he said about that. I agree with everything that you just said, and I also still have to say that I hope this doesn't turn into a speech war, mm-hmm. because even while we all know what a lot of people mean when they say those horrible things, and even though they are horrible things to say, and even though they might lead to this kind of behavior, yeah. they are legal in America, and that's not really the essential problem. The essential problem is kind of what I was trying to allude to before, that John Adams, mm-hmm. Pointed out, and a lot of founding fathers talked about, and that this particular president of the University of Kentucky seems to understand, which is he is the leader of his community, and he sets the tone and the tenor, and he has to tell these young people that their job in life is to look inward, to find order out of chaos for themselves first, and then they'll be able to bring that order to the world around them. If you are the president of a university and you recruit kids to your campus who think that their job in life is to fight for social justice at the age of 18 and take to the streets and scream at other people, you will create an environment where this kind of outcome last night in D.C. is the natural result. Mm-hmm. We need adults to restore a moral center, a sense of purpose in people, and not this idea that your job in life is to scream, fight, claw at other people, and get violent in the streets.
Right.
And so that's a sort of sounds like a, I don't know, an airy-fairy ask. Mm-hmm. And there are concrete things that have to happen. Violence on campus has to be stopped. Arrests have to be made. Yeah. Gates to schools have to be locked. People from the outside can't be let in. Foreign money should be limited. All the things that can be done should be, yeah. done. But the speech thing, while horrible and wrong and bad, yeah. should be shamed out of existence, not, yeah. legally restricted out of existence.
I agree with that up to a point. I mean, less in terms of sort of nuts and bolts of the law, and more of like Jews need to have like a theory of the case here, and they need to like argue for like, what is this movement, right?
Yes.
Is it benign or is it malignant, right? How do you relate to it? Do you, you know, how much legitimacy do you give it? And I think stigmatizing it as much as possible has become really necessary.
Yes.
100%. And saying that it should be unacceptable in civilized company.
Correct.
To align with this, to use these slogans. We've all known that they're genocidal. Mm-hmm. And it's it's nihilistic. And, you know, I was thinking of this awful murder, and I was thinking about another clip, and if you saw the past couple of days, where Zoran Mamdani, who we haven't really spoken about on this podcast, but is running second behind Andrew Cuomo and has harnessed a lot of energy among kind of young, hip progressives in New York City, had this moment at a town hall where this, you know, sort of pro-Palestine person came up and started screaming at him mm-hmm. for recognizing the right of Israel to exist, yeah. Lobar, yeah. and said, you know, how dare you, screaming about genocide. And, you know, and Zoran kind of just stood there, didn't say anything. And it just struck me that the forces that have been unleashed here are so violent, so dangerous, and so extreme that they'll eat their own, right?
100%. They'll eat us first, though, yeah. and then they'll eat their own.
Right, right. So that's always how it works.
We won't be there to enjoy it.
That's always how it works, right?
Yeah, that's how it works. I think that's right, and I think it's that's why it's more important to have, you know, presidents of the University of Kentucky and commencement addresses like that, and to have people stand up. You know, Mamdani didn't. He was the adult in the room, supposedly, at that moment, and could have said something, and he didn't. And that's what we're up against. You're correct, right? We have to name it and shame it. It has to be as impolite and wrong and embarrassing to do this as it is to go into the streets and yell at Black people that they don't yeah. belong in this country. Yeah. But it isn't. And that's on all of us. And there's no free speech, hate speech, laws that we're going to manipulate that's going to accomplish that. That's something deeper that has to do with John Adams' morality, with mm. faith, in my view, and religion. And it has to be not just the Jews who are screaming about it. It has to be the female athletes who felt yeah. the brunt of this and the yeah. Christian white males who've yeah. been feeling the brunt
or
of
the
it.
Or the diplomats. I mean, you can tell the story of this these murders as an attack on, you know, on diplomacy. On, I mean, these were all, you know, these were kind of people in that sphere. I mean, you know, what if someone murdered two Indian people at a, you know, it's a similar kind of just violent spasm that, I mean, America's always had violence and we've always had shooting violence, but this kind of attack feels more similar to something you would have in like France, to be honest. And I worry a little bit to your point about our norms being eroded, that, you know, this kind of street ugliness, yeah. you know, yeah. Is, you know, this globalized intifada, like call it what it is, yeah. right?
Well, look at Representative McIver, yeah. right, who's now been indicted for pushing her way and attacking ICE officers and pushing her way into that ICE facility, and gets up the next day and defends herself. Defends her ugliness and mm-hmm. says, I was doing my job. I mean, there's nobody left in even in the sort of responsible seats in our society who will openly say, you know, violence is wrong. I shouldn't use violence to get my way. Yeah. I mean, this is an elected official saying that and defending herself and starting a fundraising campaign yeah. to support, and she'll probably raise a lot of money off of it. Yeah. That's the rot that we're talking about. And that's what has to really stop. And as long as that continues, I don't know what rules and regulations you're going to put in place to stop this, you know, one guy with a gun or the globalized antifada crazy people at Columbia's campus. Yeah. I mean, there's just a limit yeah. to what you can do when your society countenances this kind of crazy.
Yeah. Just one more point, and that's sort of to bring it in a sort of the sort of modern or contemporary dimension of this is, and we don't know yet exactly what set off the killer besides hating Jews in Israel. But, you know, this, and we covered this, our Novi Zhukovsky covered this in the paper, that the way in which this lie that 14,000 Gazan children were going to die in the next 48 hours. Now, if that math makes sense to you, like I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you, but you know, that came from official channels and was reported everywhere, NBC yeah. and PBS, whatever, all the alphabet soups. And I saw, just speaking personally, you know, the number of Instagram stories I saw. I was scrolling through one after another, people mm-hmm. were reporting this yes. lie, and it's a blood libel. Yeah. It's just a blood libel. And I, you know, I don't know if this killer saw that and then ran out, but there's an ecosystem here,
right?
Right. Of these kind of ancient hates now have these sort of new clothes.
Yes. And even just one last, social media comment. I was scrolling also this morning, and Michael Tracy, who fills in for Glenn Greenwald, the person on his program, who I sunburned last week, his reaction to this morning was, oh boy, they're going to make this all about defending Israel, and it must be like, that we can't, they're going to come after our free speech because of this killing, and it's a false flag, and he wasn't the only one saying it. And so that's the exact kind of irresponsible, reflexive hatred and anger and whatever that thing is, that's just everybody's just coming undone in this country. Everyone's unmoored and angry and bitter, and we need more Ellie Capilutos of University of Kentucky. People have to be told to sort of straighten out.
And the young couple who was shot, I mean, they're the kinds of people, that they're the antidote, and
like
also
the victims.
Of course, these are like the beautiful people who are, have their eyes on the future. I hope, this is it's not really an Israeli story, and it's even not so much a Jew. I mean, this really should be seen as an American crisis, right? This happened not in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem.
Correct.
This happened in Washington, D.C., in our nation's capital, feet from, the great houses of government.
Yeah. As our shared mentor always talks about, right, anti-Semitism is often just a symptom of an illness in the society in which it resides. And so America's clearly got an illness. And that shooting last night is just a reflection of the deeper illness. It, as you say, it was anti-Semitism, but it's not only that. It is symptomatic of something much bigger.
And also, one of the things that struck me is the way in which the murderer sort of matriculated through these far left organizations, right? There's now kind of like a path or a trajectory.
A direct line.
And now in the last 2 years, we've seen that there's this structure now of an evil structure, and maybe funded foreign or not, whatever. But there's now an infrastructure where people's minds are being really corrupted.
Right. But that's why you brought up France, right? And that's why the rest of Western Europe has the same malady, because they have abandoned the fundamental Judeo-Christian principles that underpin those societies. That's the glue that holds our constitution together and their laws together. Mm-hmm. And without it, as John Adams points out, everything disintegrates. And so it's no coincidence that the West in particular is falling apart in this way, and that there is a direct line.
Yeah. Another, sort of, I think, warning sign here is the fact that, this killer was not Muslim, was not Palestinian, the attraction of this cause and this violence to people who are not directly affiliated with it is a real danger. And we see that in college campuses, right? And the extent to which there is now a broad-based army of people who have been inoculated, even if it's just over the past year or two, with have downloaded really ugly ideology.
And let's ask ourselves why they haven't downloaded the really good ideology of American values and Judeo-Christian values.
Yeah.
We haven't pushed them. We haven't been proud of them. And so into that vacuum stepped this ugliness. And so we're seeing the results of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, the idea of, more Jewish and Israeli spaces becoming on even further lockdown, more secure, is just depressing and brings us closer to the European situation.
100%. Right.
Where you can't walk into a synagogue without having, sent your passport in advance.
Yeah.
I mean, who wants to live like that?
Yeah. Okay. That was sad.
Yeah.
But true. Mm-hmm. Okay, make it make sense. We wanted to talk about something else that's sad.
Yeah.
And what happened in the Oval Office with the South African president, Ramaphosa.
Mm-hmm.
Ramaphosa.
Mm-hmm.
And... I guess the funny thing to say first is, anybody who steps into the Oval Office now.
I was just going to say, after Zelensky and Ramaphosa, I would think
maybe
twice.
It
just shows the power of the American presidency that people willingly
would still
walk
come.
Into.
It's like walking into the arena with the lion.
Yeah.
And you know you're going to get eaten,
yeah,
but you still show up.
Right,
what is that?
Right,
But he did. Okay. And he got eaten up. And I don't know, maybe you'll feel that it was, inappropriate of the president. And a lot of people are saying that. I don't, actually. I I thought, well, first of all, I thought it was great television, mm-hmm. but that's not the point. I think the real point is.
See, I think we're different that way. Yeah. I find these things so cringe that I have a hard time watching it.
Yeah.
Regardless of how I feel politically, I'm like, when those lights went down and the and you're just like, oh my gosh. It's like people who watch those like Americans like home videos, you know, where it's like someone's falling off the roof or something.
Well, because look, I think what I like about it is. The exposure of the sort of ridiculous lie that we're all made to sit and watch it pleasantly. We were supposed to sit there and watch this man talk about South Africa, and Trump was supposed to shake his hand, and that's what always happens. And you have this lovely, polite thing, and then behind closed doors, what really happens, happens. And even Ramaphosa brought with him that white South African soccer player as evidence that they don't kill all white people. And they don't kill all white people, but that was like his token white guy.
Yeah, and the guy said all my friends were killed.
It's like, by the way, all my friends are dead, all my farmers. You know, I don't like that we're just the lies. I think America's done with the lies. And so this is sort of like the pulling down the lights and putting the thing on the screen and just saying, we're not going to do this anymore. Like full exposure, full transparency. Mm-hmm. A lot of people get caught on the genocide word, and that's its own conversation. But what does it matter if 87% of the farmers who died were white?
Yeah,
white farmers.
No,
are targets.
But I think especially in the context of Israel, I do think we want to be careful about genocide.
Yes, like, you know, but I mean, like, the point is not to argue.
Because that's thrown around as an accusation,
100%,
and it's a lie. But
it shouldn't be. It's not true that there's a genocide of white people across. Right. South Africa, but it's sort of not really the point. The point is, if I were a white farmer today in South Africa, I wouldn't feel better that you've defined genocide correctly. Yeah. I'd still feel targeted because I am.
Yeah.
And there are economic reasons, but, you know, black farmers are not targeted in the same numbers as white farmers. Yeah. That's just true. And so I like that the truth is being exposed right in front of us. I didn't want to see him come and just be politely, you know, applauded.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's I get that. And I listen, South Africa is a really complicated place, right? I think it's possible to hold many things at the same time. One is that apartheid was terrible and evil. Two, that post-apartheid South Africa has been really troubled. I have family from South Africa, and they've all left. I mean, as not only white people, but as Jews and as business people, they found it totally inhospitable.
The B laws, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The Black Economic Empowerment laws, which are not apartheid, but, you know, they certainly are inspired
the
by
way in which,
apartheid.
Right. The remedy is often just as bad as the disease. Yeah. And remember, I mean, South Africa has led the push against Israel at the ICJ as a way from deflecting from its own failures of governance. And so it's totally not a sort of regime that we should be sympathetic to at all. And it's a country with a horrific crime problem in every
third
respect.
Third highest murder rate in the world.
In every respect. Black on black, black. So it has huge issues. It's obviously a very beautiful country. I don't know if you've been, but
it's
beyond, which, you know, as much of Africa kind of, you know, puts in high relief the failures of government and the failure that you have this sort of astonishing background and this like kind of really awful foreground in a lot of ways. I think if anyone has seen those rallies of like the Kill the Boer rallies, they're chilling. They're really chilling and really horrifying. And nobody should hesitate to say that. You know, how it was done, you know, this is, we've talked a lot before with Trump. I mean, it's always a sledgehammer, you know. Yeah. I mean, and you can nitpick about some of the images, whatever. But, I'm basically, you know, sort of on board. I mean, I think this sort of.
And don't forget Elon Musk. Standing there.
Well, Musk is staring there,
Starlink can't operate in South Africa because he doesn't have a 30% black ownership, which is required by South African law, which is a racist law.
Yeah.
And there he is from South Africa staring this man down. That was good TV too.
Yeah.
And, you know, this against the backdrop of the 59 refugees from South Africa who were brought to America, white farmers and their families, and the Democratic Party went crazy on this issue.
Yeah.
Secretary of State Rubio just had an interchange with the failed vice presidential nominee Tim Walz yesterday or the day before on this very subject. And Rubio, a Cuban American Secretary of State is arguing with white Tim Walz from Minnesota about how Tim Walz is upset that white refugees were brought to America to save their lives, yeah. because the only thing that we see in America is racism being conducted white against black.
Right.
And just like the only anti-Semitism we see is, you know, Nazis attacking Jews, and we refuse to see the other. And the world, as you say, is a complex place. South Africa is a complex place. Mm-hmm. And what happened under apartheid was inexcusable and horrible. And so is what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And the one doesn't excuse the other. And white people have a right to live. And we shouldn't have to say that out loud. And and this just felt like a basket of ripping the Band-Aid off of this idea that racism only occurs in one direction.
Right.
Racism is everywhere in the world. Every race has practiced it, and every race has been subject to it.
Yeah.
And we should oppose it all the time.
Yeah.
And so I don't care that apartheid happened. That's not an excuse for this man sitting in the Oval Office and pretending that he's not the president of a country where they are just, you know, revenge killing for things that the people they're killing didn't do themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and in the long run, right, this kind of, you know, these kind of racial politics and retribution and revenge are a recipe for being a failed state. I mean, we've seen that everywhere. And, you know, that's also sort of the obsession with the Palestinian cause is another sign of kind of a failed politics or a politics of distraction.
Right.
And so in a way, you know, I think South Africa's future is obviously going to have to be white and black. But as you said, sort of, fighting the wars of the past in the present is never really a recipe for moving forward.
And that point that you just made about, it's the signal of a society's downfall. Look at Elon Musk. He lives in America. His ingenuity, the jobs he's created, the revolutions in technology that he's inspired, they're happening here to the benefit of America. And they could have happened to the benefit of South Africa.
Yeah.
They made it an inhospitable place for a man like that to live.
Yeah.
Good luck to them.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, you know, people are going to come to America anyway, but you're right. I mean, is there a world in which, you know, South Africa, which has incredible resources, which has, you know, historically a really educated population, I mean, it has a lot of advantages, right? And certainly within the African context is something of a success story, has the legacy of Mandela. I mean, there's a lot to kind of work there with there and to see it sort of squandered this way.
Back to the president of the University of Kentucky, like build, don't destroy.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
Not, you know, to you can't redress the evils of 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but you can build something new for today. And maybe that's the lesson for Gaza too.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So our tipping point is we're still kind of tipping, like, sort of, you know, and that's, you know, the story of the Biden health cover up. And that's Jake Tapper's word. And, you know, I think this is still a really big story. You know, I know some will say it's backwards looking, you know, whatever, but it's, what interests me about it is the sort of mechanics of it. Yes, that it's kind of riveting as a sort of scandal, but just the bigger questions about lying, about, you know, sort of bad faith, about what the public deserves to know. Obviously, the latest beat in the story is this idea that horrendously and unfortunately, Biden has very aggressive and very metastatic cancer that's spread, you know, throughout his body, and just awful, awful, awful news. But sort of deepens these sort of questions about his wellness, his health, you know, and the possibility that he could have even served a second term feels even more remote and sort of ridiculous.
The sad thing for me is that those questions that you're talking about have been answered, and the answer is terrible. The answer is lying is perfectly acceptable in our society. Deception for political gain, for personal gain, all of it is just fine with a lot of people. And there's no accountability. And so now we have the answer. Like, that happens. Mm-hmm. It happened right in front of us. It happened overtly. The same people who did it wrote books about it and are making money off of it. And there's zero consequence. And so we've all just rolled our eyes and said, well, you know, that's the way the media works. That's the way the politicians work. Yeah. Nobody got fired from the media for doing it. Mm-hmm. Nobody is, again, we talked about this last week. We talked about the media and the administration. The individuals who did it are kind of, you know, is anybody even saying their names? I mean, it's just, you've asked the question and it's been answered and it's a bad answer.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's astonishing to me is that people in some ways would rather protect their own status, their own whatever, than even win elections. I mean, it had become clear to people that Biden couldn't do this pretty early in his term, and maybe even before that. And so there's this kind of, I don't know, like it's like you're on the Titanic and like you could, it's too much work to like, to change direction. So you just go into the iceberg.
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of inertia. And some of it was just greed. I mean, one of the more really egregious bits of news that came out of the Tapper and Thompson book was that Mike Donilon was paid $4 million mm-hmm. for the campaign, where the campaign manager was paid $300,000.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's just grift.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely grift. And is anybody shocked? Like you say it and we all go, yeah, all right, well, because we've seen that before and we know we're going to see it again. And, you know, I think the really hard part here is that this was reported.
Right.
Lots of people talked about it, mm-hmm. but they were all in sort of the right, whatever that means in the mm-hmm. media. Mm-hmm. So we only are paying attention because the left is finally acknowledging it as though they're like at the center of the media universe. And I don't know, there's something just wrong about who we think the mainstream media is mm-hmm. and why their acknowledgement of this now has now made it a story. Why mm-hmm. wasn't it a story when, you know, Laura Loomer said it, or I don't know, the million of other, I'm not thinking of their names, you know, Republican pundits talked about it.
I think a lot of this is sort of tribal, right? So when the right says he has Alzheimer's, he's not there, the reaction is, oh, no, he doesn't, right? I mean, but in fact, if you were really sort of reporting and thinking about it and being an honest broker, you'd sort of say, okay, well, what actually is happening, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's not just like, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I mean, it has to be, you know, a commitment to the truth and a commitment to a certain sense of integrity. I mean, some of the reporting that, you know, he couldn't, you know, do the most basic tasks is really shocking. I think one of the things that I felt at the time is the administration sort of bifurcated it, so to say, well, he's not really a good communicator, but he's a good decision maker or whatever. And that doesn't make any sense. The presidency is primarily a communicative job, mm-hmm. right? And if you can't communicate with the American people, you can't be president.
Right.
It's like saying you're an actor, but you can't speak in front of a camera.
Right.
That's crazy.
Well, and there's a lot of questions about what decisions he did or didn't make and these investigations into the AutoPen stuff, which also brings us back to our Dershowitz conversation where we asked him about this, mm-hmm. if it was illegal to have knowledge that he was incapacitated and to have not shared it with the American people. Mm-hmm. He said no, mm-hmm. but it's unethical and immoral. But I wonder, you know, the doctor, the medical unit that follows him all the time.
I just don't understand how he hasn't had a PSA in 10 years. How is that possible?
I don't believe that he didn't. Just because they said he didn't doesn't mean he didn't. I find that impossible to believe.
A man of his age. I mean, how is that?
Of course he had one, and of course they covered it up as they covered up everything. Why would we believe anything they say now?
Yeah.
Right? I simply don't. Now you have to prove to me that you're telling the truth rather than the other way around. You've lost that privilege.
Right.
So, no, I don't believe that he hasn't. I don't believe that they didn't know all along. But this is called Tipping Point, this segment.
Yeah.
And what's the tipping point here? Does anybody think that this is going to tip the media over into telling the truth? Does anybody think that the next time something similar happens that we'll get more honest journalism?
You hope. I mean, you know, I think part of this stuff is, you know, you sort of – you uncover it as you go and you, you know, you hope that that there are lessons learned. I mean –
I have less hope than you do.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's not in some abstract sense about like fixing the media. It's just sort of, I mean, this obviously was a huge story that was really missed. And it's just a reminder sometimes that
missed, ignored deliberately. Like Scarborough should be fired.
Yeah.
Jake Tapper should be fired, actually, not writing a book and making a lot of money. Like, unless that happens, there is no tipping point, right? Like what would be the incentive for the next person to act differently?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, there's, you know, I don't know. I haven't spent enough time or any time in sort of the inner sort of circle of White House and press and media. I mean, you know, part of the administration's job is to shield the president and to craft a narrative, right? So I guess that's kind of your point is like, okay, like there were the people around Biden. That's one circle of responsibility. I think when it does get to a point that it got to, I think it's fair to ask about their duty to the country and their duty to the Constitution and that kind of thing. But, you know, sort of like we were talking off camera, you know, it's the, it's the media's job to ferret this stuff out. And if they weren't doing it.
You don't have to be a ferret.
Yeah.
you can just be standing there and seeing it.
Partisan politics is so strong. I mean, when people started in a half-hearted way saying Biden shouldn't run, the blowback was so fierce, you know?
I don't know. Like, did somebody call Dean Phillips and say, sorry? You remember him?
Yeah.
The Democrat who ran, wanted to primary Biden and was, you know, beaten into submission, who just said out loud, you know, the man can't do the job. And Democrats turned on him in an instant.
Yeah.
I wonder if he got a phone call.
Yeah.
I'm guessing not.
But that's the thing, you know, right. I mean, sometimes it's like the curse of Cassandra is you're right, but nobody listens to you. Okay, should we go?
I feel that way all the time.
I was just going to say,
that's a Tuesday morning. Yeah.
Okay, sunburns.
Sunburn time.
Go ahead.
Mine is like sunburn sunlight, I guess. I'm going to try and mix them together. It was the recent FDA announcement that the COVID vaccine, or what I call the COVID mRNA technology, would no longer be on the schedule. The booster shots would no longer be on the schedule for young, healthy people. I think they're still saying if you're older or in one of those categories, people might be susceptible. Maybe
they,
you know, you might want to consider it, but certainly not for anybody else. That's the sunlight, is that it's finally come off the schedule. The sunburn is that it's been there until now, when we know that it doesn't prevent the spread of COVID. It doesn't help people when, you know, it's not even true that healthy people, you know, have a lighter form of the disease, or it's a technology, not a vaccine. And there has been ample evidence. Peter McCullough was testifying yesterday about the many, many harms. They're now going to have to label some of the potential harms, like myocarditis specifically in young men, on the actual vaccines. So this is a technology that, in my personal view, has caused tremendous harm, perhaps more harm than good. But even if you don't agree with that, there are very few people left who are arguing that, you know, people who don't have comorbidities need it. And it shouldn't have been required in the first place, but it certainly shouldn't have been recommended as a booster. Some people I know have had 5 or 6 of these boosters, and I shudder to think at the consequences for their health. And so my sunburn is to all the people who let it go this far. And the sunlight is, hopefully, we've moved past that now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My sunburn is at the DOJ, for, you know, opening this investigation into Andrew Cuomo. Now, Cuomo is a complicated figure. I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk more about it. It's not so much about whether he's guilty or not of lying to Congress. It's just the optics of doing this right before the election, mm-hmm. after dropping the case against Eric Adams. I mean, you know, it's just so heavy-handed. It's so transparent, picking winners and losers. And as a New Yorker, I kind of resent it. Stay out of our election. You know, we have our politics are screwed up enough. You know, and like, you know, we have enough issues.
If the intent was to bump the Adams campaign.
Yeah.
It may just bump the
right. Well, this is always the problem. Is
it's Zohra Mamdani campaign, and we might end up with
exactly.
Him.
It just feels kind of like throwing a grenade into what's already kind of a gnarly situation.
This is where I'm going to let you have your sledgehammer moment.
Yeah.
Like, and agree with it. Like, this was a sledgehammer kind of attack, and it's going to do a lot more damage than good.
Yeah. Either way, meaning if you hate Cuomo, this could boost him if he's seen as now a martyr, or it could, you know, I don't see any good coming from this kind of thing.
Right.
You know, and if it goes forward and he wins the election, the idea that he's then on trial while being mayor, it's going to be even more like New York disaster.
Yeah.
And sort of. So yeah. I would just say kind of like, hopefully this is just a kind of, you know, bully on the playground tool. And I just hope we're spared, you know, more of these prosecutions. I thought the Adams thing was ridiculous, but at least it was dropping a case, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I think bringing a case in this way is, and yeah, I think it obscures some of, you know, Trump's, you know, somewhat meritorious arguments that there were a lot of frivolous lawsuits against him and that justice was politicized to a certain extent. This is certainly not the way to strengthen that case.
Strategically also, isn't it just so odd? Because there you have a man who was thrown under the bus by his own Democratic Party. So you would imagine that if he did win, he wouldn't exactly be their best friend. And that might be to your advantage if you're a Republican.
The left hates him, you know. And New York is sort of moving to the right anyway, right?
So why, politically. If you're on the right, would you want to make yourself the enemy now? Just let him have his enemy on the left.
And, right. And I don't think I don't think he and Trump have a lot of beef. I could be wrong, but I don't know. It's not like a sort of, you know, one of these like
never thought I'd hear myself defending Andrew Cuomo, but here I am. Thanks for that.
We'll see you next week.